Yeah. Oh, all right. Hello, my name is Doria. Hi. And I'm a grateful member of Al-Anon. Because without Al-Anon, I wouldn't be who I am today. I know a lot more about myself and my potential of what I had when I was born to just blossom, because this program taught me how to communicate first with myself, actually first with the people in the meeting that I first walked into, of whom I had nothing in common with. And I said, I'm out of here. Okay. What can I do? I'll give you 2 weeks to help me solve this problem of my alcoholics. And of course, that was never going to happen. So I went away for 6 months. This just happened to be my higher power set us up so well. It happened to be all I had to do without brakes or gas. Step in my car, close the door, take off the brake, and I'd roll right down the hill. And this is in a busy city. And there was the best meeting in town. The best meeting in town that I was asked by these people to come back at least 2 times a week. And I said, I'm sorry. You're lucky I'm here at all. I have such a busy schedule, and this man is just kind of wrecking it, and we can't get on with our life because he's got a problem. So, I'm so glad he had that problem, because if it wasn't alcohol or drugs, what could we specifically get help for? We're so lucky to be here. It's something specific. And from that spot, then we can say, okay, I know this spot. Now I'm going to try another one. Okay, I know that spot. It's one step. It's 12 steps. Now, most of these people in the room work the same 12 steps, but they have different assignments than I do as an Al-Anon. We are different. And for the new people in both programs, we are really different. But we have the same human desires. It's just that, you know, the world revolves around the alcoholic. And for the Al-Anon, it revolves around the alcoholic. So, when I first came in, there was a broken marriage. There was a fantasy. There was a really nice relationship I had with this friend. But I really thought that things should be worked out. At that time in the 70s, by the way, there were no cell phones back then. So if you had to call your sponsor, you had to find a pay phone. You know, I mean, you are so lucky now. Excuse me. What do I say? Okay, I betcha. You know. So we actually had to learn how to say, stop. I think I have to go to the bathroom. Excuse me. Or, oh my gosh, I'm late. Or, oh, thanks so much, but I forgot something. I gotta go. You know. Or, you know, especially the times when you're with your alcoholic and they're at a party and they're doing their thing and they're just like leaving the planet, and yet you're going to have to go home in the car with them. And if you say you don't want to go home in the car with them, it's more than just that. It's a huge drama and everybody knows about it. Right? So how do you handle those things? Well, I'm going to skip to the very last tradition. It's not a step, although the step brought the tradition, which is, the first part is, yes, hold on there. Because it's anonymity. It's, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all our traditions, ever reminding us to put principles above personalities. And when you're crazy, when you don't know why you can't have that next fix. And I used to take drugs. I didn't take alcohol. That's a whole nother story. But when you don't understand why you can't take that, and then you don't understand why it's your child's birthday, it's your birthday, it's time to go home, and it doesn't happen, you know, this is what you learn in your program. You learn what is the principle here, not the personality. The personality is, I love this person, but they're not understanding me. The principle is, it's late, it's dangerous, and we've got kids, and we have to go home. So I'll tell you what, and you keep it simple. Remember that phrase, keep it simple. I have money in my pocket, I'm going to get a cab. I have my cell phone, I'm going to call my friend. It happens before the person who's not even there in their head can make a bigger scene than is being made now. The principle is to be safe. You know, the reason for the program initially was to keep the friends and families of alcoholics together. But you know, now we're dealing with business. I have been in the program for, he's 23 years sober, and I was in the program for 5 years before, but I knew him for 2.5 years before that. So that's how long it's been. So 28 years. And, I have learned how to pull away from the situation I've done everything I can. So now I have to do what? Create my new interests and activities, take care of business. And in doing so, I had some dreams and some goals, which what kept us together is this person had a problem and couldn't solve it himself. But he saw that my life kept moving on. I still was attending with my love. I said, I love you. I love this phrase. This is really hard to learn how to say, which is, well, I love you, but I just can't help you. You know? And then how to say the one my sponsor would tell me about, this is unacceptable behavior. Those weren't my words. You know, so I remember one time I lived in a two-story, very tall building, and we happened to have a yard in the back, very small, and there was happened to be a very long ladder, and he thought he would be really cute. So he's really loaded, and he goes all the way down the 90 steps, comes around the backyard, goes up the stairs, and he's looking in the kitchen window. And he thinks this is going to do it. You know, I'm not going to get pissed off that he's drinking again, that problems are going to happen just in this one day that didn't have to happen if he didn't go drink. So he thinks he's going to be so cute, just popping his little head in the window, and it's like, you know, I don't know, a 36-foot ladder. I don't know. All he has to do is this, and it's really over. And I was taught to say, I love you, but I can't help you. And you know what? He climbed down the stairs, and that one didn't work. You know, it was okay. And there was a series of, I'm going to do this, but it's not going to work. For some of you who are in a new relationship and you're in Al-Anon and your alcoholic is out of control sometimes, you're afraid to let them go. There's a phrase, let go and let God. You're afraid to let them go because if they don't come to you, they'll go to somebody else. You know, and that's the first time when it's really hard to let go. But when you're scared and you've done the right thing and you've got a program behind you, you've got somebody to talk you through your feelings, you've got a meeting you can go to. One time I went to a meeting and it was an hour and a half away and I didn't care because I was really desperate. And you know what God did for me, my higher power? It was a district meeting and they were showing, and back then that was kind of a big deal, a movie on Lois. It was a story of Lois's life. So I thought, wow, okay, that's cool. You know, I guess my higher power is with me. I stayed out of his hair, and there were kids involved. I stayed out of their hair, just making it more dramatic. But that's the first thing, is being afraid of letting him go to the people in the bar or the drug, you know, friends or whatever. It's like I had to be able to delineate my barriers when certain situations came up. I was allowed some drama. I like drama. That's why I got together with him. You know, we all like drama. But how can we put that drama to good use? And how can we use it to climb this huge hill called life that constantly knocks you down? And the other one is the scary one, is when they finally get sober. I had never called my friend a name. This is our special relationship. I never called him up. You know, Whatever we did until I got into the program. Then I got into the program, I learned things to say. But this one time, he was out in some, making some movie with these young kids and blah, 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 blah. And he calls me up, and I had had it. I had said many times to my sponsor, I want to leave, I want to leave. She says, well, do you have this? Do you have this? No. Well, then let's just wait till you're really ready. Well, after this phone call, I said to him, I do not care where you are. I don't care what you're doing. I don't care what the F you're taking, but you are a, I said, that's it. I don't care. Click. I never hung up on the phone. You know, so, and I called with my other hand, my sponsor, and I said, okay, I am ready. You know, I am ready for a plan. They didn't have computers then. They had word processors. So she made me take a word processor course. Because, well, whatever, that's another story. But anyway, I just want to tell you, it was really scary. At that point, he went into the program, and I said, oh, shoot. I'm finally ready to leave. And now this guy, my best friend, would prove me a hypocrite. All these years, I didn't really care for him if I leave now. I got to give the guy a break. I have a little background so I can have a little more patience. And I want to tell you, somebody told me in a meeting that the first two years of sobriety are as crazy as the last 2 years of reaching the bottom. Well, that meant I had to step up my program. And I did. And you know, it's 23 years later. We're still together. Okay. So the last thing is, it's scary when you have to turn your alcoholic over to the meetings, because there's a lot of love there, there's a lot of support, because each day when they go to a meeting and they meet with that special friend, they have dialogue they can share that they can't share with you. It just doesn't, you just don't understand it. You try, but obviously. Anyway, this is my book. It gets old, has lots of tape on it, and I like having it fall apart and keeping it with me, because it shows me the path that I've been on all around the world with my program. And I thank God. I'm very proud of him, and I know tonight he could slip, and that's scary. But you know what? I'm really proud of the most courageous thing any person could do in the privacy of their heart and their minds, is not to take that thing. And look at all the support each one of you has around you. It's very beautiful. Thank you for this opportunity to share.
Hi, everybody. My name's Craig. I'm an alcoholic. Really good to be here. Now you're going to hear the truth. I knew what the hell was going on every minute. Except for 1975. I didn't know one. What an incredible thrill it is to be here. Be sober today. And to see all the sobriety in this room is just fantastic. It's humbling. That was so beautiful, this, Katie, what you did and the signing of the book. And congratulations on the newcomer and all the newcomers, and congratulations to the people with time we got today. And that's about it, isn't it? You know? Keep coming back. It's been great to be here. My first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, I had maybe 15 minutes, and Dory was with me. It was the Palm Springs Convention, the roundup in Palm Springs, and Chuck C. was the featured speaker. And they didn't have a place for me to reside, to sit down, so I just laid down right here in front. I felt privileged even then. And Chuck C. was there, Clancy was there, and all these people, and they introduced Chuck C., and he comes out in a wheelchair, and he'd had an oxygen tank, and he had the nose pieces, and basically what happened was, as I was lying there, there was a standing ovation. Chuck C. and everybody stood up, and I thought, my God, you know, he looks terrible. And he basically got up out of the wheelchair, and he said, keep coming back. And he sat down, and people just went nuts. Nuts. And I thought, you know, this is the craziest son of a bitchin' program I have ever seen in my life. You know, I'm going to be an invalid. I'm going to have an oxygen tank. I'm going to say, keep coming back. People are going to applaud, and I'm going to want a drink. I mean, what is the... The great fact is just this and nothing less, that we have had deep and effective spiritual experiences which have revolutionized our whole attitude toward life, toward our fellows, and towards God's universe. The central fact of our lives today is the absolute certainty that our Creator has entered into our hearts and lives in a way which is indeed miraculous. He has commenced to accomplish those things for us which we could never do for ourselves. That's what's happened to me in Alcoholics Anonymous. I started drinking when I was 13 years old. I'm from Spokane, Washington. I don't know if my parents were alcoholics. They were crazy. But I don't know, and I'm not sure it really matters. But I started drinking when I was 13. I stole beer from my parents. And, you know, in Spokane, Washington, and growing up in those days, it was idyllic. It was, we had a park a block and a half from our house. In the winter, we would go skating on the ponds, and I'd come home, and my mother would make hot chocolate with marshmallows in them, and we had a fire, and there was a Christmas tree, and it smelled of fir, and it was lit perfectly, and she used to make those icicles, you know, so straight, and she used to smooth each one out. Hell, she used to iron my shorts, and it was wonderful and beautiful, and autumn would roll around, and you'd have the full moons, and you'd have these glorious Indian summers, and this wonderful aroma of leaves as you would ride your bicycle through them, and sometimes you'd put cards on the spokes of your bike and it would sound like a motorcycle, and you'd visit your friends down the street and everybody knew, hey Craig, how you doing? And, you know, it was like a prairie home companion. It was just a wonderful, wonderful existence, and there was always something warm and wonderful at home. There wasn't too many fights, you know, there wasn't some kind of weird thing going on in somebody's life that I knew about. It was just wonderful. And by the time I was 18, I could hardly wait to get the fuck out of there. But, I mean, it was an incredible... It just didn't feel right. It just didn't feel right. It didn't have... Something was missing. But I always felt, as a child, detached and lonely and afraid and frightened and totally... I was sure I was adopted, and I couldn't have come from those two people, and it just didn't fit in anyway. But the point being is that I stole that beer, and the first thing I remember about stealing it and was not the guilt or the remorse for stealing it. It was the fact that I threw up. And from the time I was 13 till the time I graduated high school, I don't think I ever kept a six-pack of beer down. And I remember telling some friends of mine, because they were hesitant to take me with them when they went out drinking. They thought, well, what is the problem? And I says, you know, I could be allergic to hops. I could be allergic to hops. Or it could be yeast. You know, it could be the yeast thing. But, I tried switching, you know, we drank Olympia from Tumwater, and maybe it was the Tumwater, whatever the hell that was. You know, I tried Rainier, and that didn't taste very good. You know, I tried all the beers that they had going back then, and nothing really worked, you know. I mean, it was, and I got a lot of headaches, and so I didn't, you know, I wasn't a, you know, I just didn't fit in, but I drank to fit in. That's what I did, and fight, you know, you had to fight and drink, and that's what you did. And you didn't shoot each other. That was a cowardly way to, I mean, my God, anyway, but... You know, we fought and we drank, and then we drove around our cars, and then we stole our parents' cars when we got the chance. And my dad was dying from emphysema, and so by the time I was 17 or 18, I was in full-fledged denial of what was going on in the back bedroom. And this was a tall, strapping Norwegian man that had. I think as a boy had worked in the mines and had gotten in a sulfa mine. And to this day, I'm allergic to sulfa, but I'm not sure what caused it, but it was probably smoke, whatever, he's dying. And I couldn't bring kids home to introduce them to my dad. So it was this kind of, my mom wouldn't explain to me, you know, she's losing her life mate. And she didn't have reasons for what was going on and how to feel. So I went through high school with kind of this feeling of inferiority and not knowing. And when he died, you know, I was present, but I wasn't there. You know what I mean? I wasn't there. I didn't know what was going on. I remember the casket and all that, and I don't remember specifically. And the next thing I know, you know, I'm married. And, you know, and... And by the way, my ex-wife, Robin, is right here in the front row tonight. Now, that's a testimony to Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to tell you. We're married, and I'm off and gone, and I'm just a kid, and she's a kid, and we don't know what we're doing, and I certainly don't know what I'm doing, and next thing I know, I'm, you know, go trying to flunking out of college and not really doing a lot of, I don't have any money. And I don't know what I'm going to do. I think I'm going to be in the CIA. So I went to do an interview with the CIA. I mean, that seemed like a good career. I didn't even know what it stood for. But it was, huh?
Catholic, Irish, alcoholic.
Okay, keep coming back. Catholic, Irish, alcoholic. Well, yeah, anyway. I was in ROTC. So I figured CIA, it was initials, you know. Flunked out of that school, went to Yakima, and found drama, and ended up loading helicopters for Robin's dad in Phoenix, Arizona. And didn't drink or had no money. And ended up at Tucson going to the University of Arizona on a drama scholarship. And our first child came along who is sitting right there and has got 5 days?
A week
of sobriety. It's 5 days. You're not kidding me. I don't know. It's whatever it's been. Congratulations. Boy, I tell you, Al-Anon. Al-Anon, boy. Child? Well, anyway. You can't heal him. You can just love him. Drama scholarship at the University of Arizona found... $50 key marijuana.
Yeah.
All right. In this whole group, there's one pothead. You know, I mean, it's like, come on. Come on. Let's do a countdown. Let's just see. Let's do the old marijuana countdown. I don't know about you. Now, beer made me throw up. Marijuana made me paranoid as hell. I couldn't smoke. It was terrible. I mean, I had a grade 56 Studebaker that I painted day-glow red. All of the instruments were day-glow red, and it had tuck and roll Nogai upholstery from Nogales. It was a beautiful cherry red 56 Studebaker. Barely started. I got loaded on Speedway Boulevard in Tucson, and I swear to God, I still haven't forgot it. I have never been that scared in my entire life. A guy passed me a joint, said, here, try this, and this is what you do, and I did it. And the next thing I know, I mean, it was full-on hallucination paranoid time. I mean, I swore to God, I saw the lights in the rearview mirror. I said, we're being pulled over. He turned around, and he's one of those guys that's like, hey, it's cool, man. It's cool, you know. They pull you over. You can, no, I'm telling you, man, we're being fucking pulled over. Yeah. He says, like, chill out, man. Take it easy. Cool it. Jeez, what's wrong? I don't know. I don't know. Well, here, have another hit. No, yeah. Okay, so it didn't work. That didn't work. And somewhere in 1967, I left there and came to Hollywood on the whim that we could probably make a living doing something in show business. And I worked as a security guard at Whackin' Hut in Los Angeles. And the reason I did that, because they'd give you a job in a day. They didn't really have much of an interview system going on there. Can you stand up? Can you say yes, sir, no, sir? You're hired. Here's a gun with one bullet. So I was sent out to Lever Brothers to guard the soap plant out there in the city of commerce. You know, and God knows how many communists were going to be attacking the Lever Brothers because... But I was ready for them, whoever they were. I in my Whackin' Hut uniform, and I went out there and working the midnight shift with Heiner Thomas, who had once knocked out Archie Moore and was still here in the Bell from the fourth round. And Heiner became one of my dearest friends. But anyway, we're out there guarding Lever Brothers, and I'm thinking about this one bullet thing, and I'm thinking now, if somebody attacks Lever Brothers, I guess that bullet's for me. Oh. I had an inflated sense of who I was. So anyway, left Lever Brothers and got another scholarship at the Oxford Playhouse in Los Angeles and eventually ended up with a partner by the name of Barry Levinson. I really hate to break that anonymity, but anyway, Barry's not on stuck on any. Doesn't go to any meetings. Just his own. Barry and I became partners. We did stand up for 4 years, and then we wrote together, and eventually we got a show called Loman and Barclay, and which was an hour-long show. And to make a long story short, I was working for $90 a week back then, doing a 90-minute live show. And I had then we had two children. And the Comedy Store, I got hired off of that show to go work for another show on network and as a writer, performer. And started making a little bit more money, and that's when acid was big. So my manager at that time was a guy by the name of Neil Anderson, and he was his nickname was Captain White Folks. And this was the coolest human being. This is a former Hell's Angel who had a degree in psychology from USC. Now, put those two together, and you got a roaring alcoholic drug addict. And he was a major dealer in heroin and cocaine in the Los Angeles district and also marijuana. So I would go over to his house and partake of and sample some of the things that he had, which was like synthetic mescaline and blue barrel acid in case... Acid? LSD? Yeah. Okay, anyway... Good old blue barrels and little synthetic mescaline, and let's drive 35 miles to go back home again. And when your nostrils are so caked with this yellow powder that you can't even think, and your cerebral cortex is about to snap. And all of a sudden on the Hollywood freeway, you think you're upside down. And you continue to drive that way. Going home. So that was acid, and That was that kind of period of time. And then it was like the Comedy Store opened in 73, and a friend of mine, Barry, and I, and Rudy DeLuca, who opened the Comedy Store with Sammy Shore, would perform there. And that's when I really found more alcohol and a little bit more drugs, and I would come home and have to be taken down, and I was having bad acid attacks is what I was having, you know, trips. And they were getting to the point where it was unbearable, and it was one of those things where, well, why don't you stop doing it? Well, that's an option, yeah. Okay, that's a suggestion there. That. But we didn't. And in 73, and so I started doing some other shows. And by the mid 73, I guess it was, we decided that having lost the house and the our van had been foreclosed on. Because it was a living space. We're going to move up to the mountains in Northern California and get out of show business and the stuff that goes on in a city. Move up to the country and Jeremiah Johnson it and be like the Waltons and grow our own food and raise a family up in God's country, you know, and the mountains. And the trees and the air and the streams and mountain lions and bears and stuff you can kill and eat them, you know. And so we packed up the van and we left and went up to Northern California up near Shasta and flipped a coin on I-5 and you had two choices. At Redding, we flipped a coin. You'd go up to Whiskey Town or French Gulch, which I thought sounded rather good, but we flipped the coin. We ended up in Round Mountain, California, and found 40 acres and built a I built a log cabin. That's what I did. Now, I didn't know how to build anything. I'd never built anything in my life, but I had a book on how to build your own log cabin. And I figured if you read that book, why the hell not? You know, I mean, come on. So we started out with a trailer and lived in a trailer for a long time. And then I started building the log cabin. And unfortunately, we had 40 days of rain. And some of the pages in the log cabin book got stuck together. So I missed a section in there. So I thought I'd start off with a chicken coop. And I built a chicken coop because if chicken coop looked okay, I figured, okay, we can adapt some kind of thing and then I can build the house and looking like kind of, I just wanted to see if I could build something. I wanted to see if I could hold a hammer. But you got to chop trees down, you got to haul them up, and how do you do that? You got to get a horse. Yeah, I got no power, electricity. I had no power, I had nothing. No running water, no electricity. I had to get my own, come on. You know, so we got a horse. Went over there and old Chuck Bays, who's the horseshoer, the gypsy horseshoer down there in Round Mountain, he lived on Buzzard Roost Road. He sold me a stolen horse. I didn't know it was stolen at the time. And I called him Jericho and brought Jericho home. And Norm Brown, who lived down in Big Bend, he gave me a set of traces to haul the logs up with. So I sawed the logs down with a chainsaw, which I'd never operated before. But I sawed them down, didn't hurt myself, loaded them up and gave them to old Jericho and thought, you know, what the heck? Come on, Jericho. Come on, dude. This horse did not want to, hated me. He didn't want to haul log. He didn't even know what a log was. Well, you know, the log is behind him. He's scared shitless. He runs off. Now you got to chase the horse and you got to get your logs back. And you sure don't want anybody seeing you doing this because you, it's real hot and you can't. So anyway, the van turned out to be the hauler and I tore out the bumper of the van hauling logs up. And eventually we got some kind of a house going up there. And I worked as a teacher and a plumber, a surveyor. I logged for a while. I made shakes and shingles. We tried to grow our own food, got water up there to some degree, had methane. You know, things were just going great, you know, and was just having fun and getting out in the winter and sledding down the hill. And the kids still remember it as like being one of the best times ever. Kerosene lights, you know, and no electric. It was just really hell. But I mean, it was up to a point. It was fun, and you know. And so I'm thinking, well, I'm not using or drinking, really. I mean, I still have the same problem. I can't smoke, and all the guys up there are Vietnam vets. They've all come back from psych ops. You know, they're still hearing helicopters going. But they're growing the best dope you could get anywhere, I guess. You know, I mean, they are growing some stuff. I don't even know what it is. They brought back some seeds, you know, from over there. I'm sure the Cambodian thing. Boy, that stuff was... I sat in a trailer one afternoon with a guy. Anyway, with the not drinking because I couldn't afford it. Trying to do... So eventually I had to hitchhike back to earn some money. And the family's starving. Marriage isn't doing well. We have no... You know, basically can't make the land payments. Hitchhike back somewhere in 78, 77, 78. And... found a job working for this cable company doing these documentaries. And the documentaries that I did was called America Still, and it was about people that moved out of the city into the country. And I thought, who better to tell their story than me? And I did 54 half hours of that. In the process, a guy walked into my office, and it was Columbia Studios in Gower. And he said, I want you to try something. And he laid this stuff out, and he went. That was it. Rolled up a dollar bill, put my nose in there. Gone. Gone. I was Chatty Cathy. I knew the answer to stuff I didn't even know. I was a new person. I'd refound myself, reborn, reeducated. I was smart again, erudite. I could speak well. I had tonality. And it was fun. And you could drink all night. All night. And I found I could work under it. I could actually work with it. You know, you just hide the little handshaking once in a while. But hey, you know, that only happened rarely if you had enough, you know. So I was doing that, and one night I was out with somebody, and they said, do you realize how many of those you've had? I was a gin and tonic guy, by the way. And I said, no, I really don't. I don't count them. And they said, you've had 16. Isn't that funny? I don't feel a thing. What the heck are they doing to gin? Woohoo! I ended up divorced in a situation that was untenable with myself. I was heading downhill. Real quick. I was performing. I was working. But I had begun this slow decline. I ended up in Bangkok, Thailand, doing a film. And Doria came to visit me there, and she opened the door, or I opened the door. One of us opened the door. And she took a look at me, and she said, my God, Craig, what's happened to you? And I thought I had dysentery. You know? I did. But I also had severe cocaine addiction, and I was absolutely gray. I was killing myself. And I knew it, but in Bangkok, it's okay, because that's where you go to kill yourself. You can get anything you want. Anything at all, you can get there. And I tried everything, and nothing was working. And so I made a decision that if I could just make it back to Los Angeles, maybe I could get off Valium, speed, alcohol, and all the other drugs I was doing. And maybe I could be okay. So I used to carry with me a kit, a medical kit, I called it. It had everything I needed for instant recognition and awareness. And I took as much Thai stick as I could smuggle, and Valium and Captagons back with me, and I ended up in Los Angeles. And Dory and I are living together, and I'm sitting there, and she's in some program that I don't even know where she goes, with people I don't really want to know about. But she's detaching from me. There's no longer the game. You know, if I come home and I don't have my key and break the window, if there's nobody to play with, what's the fun in that? You know. And all of a sudden, it's like, I'm sorry, but she's saying to me, I can't deal with you right now. Or, you know what, Craig? Your behavior is really unacceptable. What? Why? My cat, Nelson, when I walked in the door, if I were loaded, would take a look at me and go, ah! I mean, he didn't even have to smell my breath. He just said, yeah, he would. He would sit on my lap after I passed out, and he would smell the fumes from the... So I decided to get out Valium, and I said, I'll do it on my own. So I took 3 days out of work schedule and just got out Valium. I was doing 8 milligrams of Valium, three pops, usually every 4 hours. I was a very mellow guy. Very mellow. And then I'd load up on speed to counteract that. So you can imagine the chemical imbalance that was going on. But I'd get off Valium, and the spiders are dropping from the ceiling. No one told me that getting off Valium is a very hard thing to do on your own. And so the bed was sweaty, and I was with the spiders dropping, and it was just another bad trip. And then a friend of mine stopped by and said, you know what? I'm going to an Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. Do you think you want to go? A what? Yeah, I'm going to an alcoholic. So I went. And I said, I'll meet you there. And I went drunk. And it just looked like to me it was a men's stag meeting in Plummer Park in Los Angeles. It looked like to me it was just a bunch of used car salesmen that were very unsuccessful. It's really... my first impression. And a guy gave me a key, and it said, when in doubt, turn it over. Well, gee, thanks. I had no idea what it meant, what, huh? So there, another guy that I knew said, you know, how about going to a meeting? And I said, okay, I'd love to go to meetings. He says, why? And I says, well, because I was drinking wine. I'll get my wine, I'll meet you out front of the place. No, we don't do that. I says, I do. That's how I go to so Alcoholics Anonymous. Come on. Alcohol. Anonymous, no one knows I'm there. What the hell? I mean, went out there and I saw this guy. This was at Radford in a little church. Guy stood up there and he said, hello, my name's Clancy Emerson, I'm an alcoholic. And I'm outside. Well, he starts telling the story of Jekyll and Hyde with Spencer Tracy, Lana Turner, and Ingrid Bergman. And he's doing all the parts. I have never laughed so hard in my life. And I thought, God, if I could just have a life back, if I could be that person I want to be, if I could be funny, then I would give it up. But I can't work without it. I can't do it. So I thought I'd give it a try. And I went into this meeting, and it was like sometime in August in 1983. And I had 30 days of sobriety, and I thought, geez, this is really interesting. I got a call to go to New York, and I went to New York to do a Broadway play with two people, 3.5 hours long. Was in rehearsals, and they fired the other actor. So I had to go drink. I mean, by God, they fired the other guy. How dare they fire the other guy? I mean, he's my friend. And they hired another guy. I don't care who that is. They hired him. We went into rehearsals, and I'm drinking. And I'm kind of keeping it cool. And we're into performances, three acts now, and we're getting pretty good reviews, and just the two of us. And I'm starting to notice that in the second act that usually I've gone through 2/5 of Cavassier. So I'm doing the third act, and I'm working on my 3/5. And I'm using coffee because that way no one knows. Somewhere January 19th or 20th of 1984, we were in the second act, and I had a blackout. And I woke up at the end of the play taking a bow. And people were plotting and standing. My goodness. And I was sopping wet, crying. I looked over at my partner, Ronnie Silver, and he's going, and I'm thinking, what is he so upset about? I have no idea what we did, but it was good. I mean, people were... Now all I got to do is find the right chemicals to get there again. You know? I mean, that's going to be a problem. I know that. Went backstage, and Doria was there, and she came... She said, after the director and the writer tried to get a hold of me and kill me, she said, well, that's the most humiliating thing I've ever seen you do. And I said, you know what? I've had it. I'm done. I'm through. I can't do it anymore. I was in that state of pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. I had no place to go, nobody to talk to. I knew there was a meeting just off of Columbus Avenue at the YMCA. I'd been there before. And I ran down there. Ran. And I prayed to God on my way down Columbus Avenue, full tilt, please let them be there. What if they've left? And I got there, and you were still there. And I sat down, and that was January 21st, 1984. And that's my sobriety date. But by the grace of God and the principles of this program, Alcoholics Anonymous, that's all I've got. And I've got all of the cares and the frustrations and the woes of being a lot of you think that I am. I know there's some resentments about that. A lot of you just don't give a shit, and I side with you. And the thing about Alcoholics Anonymous for me is it always grounds me. There isn't a time when I first got sober, and I was doing a series, and I had no idea how to do it. I had no idea what to do. I'd always drank. That's what I did. And now I'm on a show, and I've lost a little weight, I'm looking better, people are commenting, my God, you look good. Because normally they had to come to the dressing room and drag me out. I had 2 heart attacks. God bless you. And one of the directors came, the director came to me and he said, you know, Craig, you know, we're not getting this scene. You're not doing it. I mean, we need something and you're not providing it. And I knew it. I just didn't have all of the resentment, the anger and the fear and the frustration. A lot of it had gone. A lot of it had been lifted. I was a little lighter. I didn't know what to do. You know? So I went over in a corner and I thought, God, what should I do? And he says, a voice I heard says, I'll show you. Thanks for asking. Then I went back and it was there. What I had was new. I wasn't familiar. I didn't know how to use it right necessarily, but it was his stuff, not mine. So every time that I'm working now, I get a chance to reinvent myself through him, through this higher power. Because I've been taught that unless I have a maintenance, a spiritual connection, and I maintain that spiritual connection, then I'm no good to anybody. And yeah, I lose it. Of course I do. My ego comes in there. But you know what? I wouldn't have what I've been given today. And most of the times that I'm asked to go to work, you know what it's really about? There's someone who needs this program on the set. Or there's someone in the program that's working there that says, hey, I heard you speak, and yeah, your friend of Bill's? Hey, your friend of Bill's? And it's like fantastic, you know? It's a connection. Because I know the only reason I'm there is because of that. I'm going to end with, I'm going to tell you this fairly quick story. I got my youngest son, Noah, went with me up to Spokane to visit my parents' grave. I didn't know where my dad had been buried or my mom. So I took Noah with me. We're in Spokane. We're going to go visit the grave. So we got suits on. I got flowers. And my brother-in-law was an alcoholic and had beaten my sister. And my sister had died. And she died of a brain tumor, but also of a broken heart. Anyway, he's an alky. And I've asked Bob to go with me and presented him a big book and all of that. Well, guess what? He got sober. So we're up there, and I'm up there with this guy who's also reinventing himself, and I go to the graves, and it's me and Noah, little Noah. I think he was about 8. We get a rental car, and we're going to go out, and we go out to the graves, and like, where do you find them? And they show you the plot, and I'm driving. Get out there. We get out of the car, you know, all suits, and Noah's looking great, and I got the flowers, and just start getting over to where they are, where the graves are, and these rainbirds go on. Jeez. Noah says, well, Dad, you know, what should we do? I said, well, let's not panic here. Who the fuck is... What do you see about turning these things off, for God? Who turns them on? So we go out there, and eat some flowers going like this. I'm there to make amends to my mom and dad in the grave. And hey, I'm getting all wet, mom and dad. I love you. Noah, you got anything you want to say? No? Yeah. Jeez, man. God, I've been planning my whole life to say, I'm sorry. See ya. Go over to the car and it's sopping wet, and I'm sopping wet, and Noah's just sopping wet, and he's going, Dad, that was really funny. And I go, yeah, yeah, wasn't that great? Wasn't that funny? Just wet. Well, I'm supposed to go to a meeting with my brother-in-law at Coeur d'Alene Lake. They had a fireside meeting. So we get in the thing, we dry off, go out to the meeting, and I'm sitting there, and campfire meeting, Coeur d'Alene Lake, dusk, moon's coming up. Beautiful place, you know. My brother-in-law, Bob, is sober, and he's there. And I says, you know, today I was at this grave, you know, my mom and dad, and the rainbirds came, and people are going, oh, man, isn't that funny? Yeah, well, geez, keep coming back. Yeah, oh, well, yeah. And I'm going, I have no, why? What the hell? There's something weird there. Get in the boat, and we're going across the lake to Bob's place, and Bob looks at me and he says, you really don't know what that was about? And I said, no, I have no idea. He said, Craig, the day your dad was buried, we got to the gravesite, and the rainbirds had filled his grave with water. And I went, what? He says, yeah, we had to wait and pump out the water so we could bury, put the casket in the hole. I said, Bob, that is so my dad's sense of humor. That is just like him. That's what he would do. Hey, Craig, look. And I realized as we're that if Bob had not gotten sober, I never would have heard that. And if I hadn't gotten sober, I never would have been able to respond to it. And all of the sobriety and all of the interconnection of the people that have gotten sober for just that instant hit me. And then it left. And it was like this beautiful cohesiveness to the program that puts us in the same place with the same hearts at the same time. God bless you.